everybody. Today is a historic day because there's only 7 days left. Actually, there's 6 days left, but we have a postcast wrap-up check-in type of thing. So this is the official countdown. 7 more days until we are all done with the 2020 Nano Gangbang.
Woohoo!
So for those of you joining this terribly disreputable podcast in progress, this is the NaNoWriMo write-through for the Everyday Novelist podcast. We are on day 24 for the year 2020. A lot of 20s in there. I am your host, J. Daniel Sawyer. I am joined by your co-host,
Kitty DeKeon,
and by two of our three excellent writers. Alexis is homesick today, but she will probably be joining us tomorrow. We have
Tori
and
Gail Carriger.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm kind of in a groove. I also want to get this over with quick. We all want to get this over with quick tonight because I'm in a groove and Kitty's half asleep and Tori's cold and Gail's in the middle
wants
of
to go to
work.
Bed.
So yeah. Oh, wants to
yeah,
go to bed.
And I'm starving.
It's bedtime for yes.
So let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's do the check-in real quick, and then we have a question from the forums that shouldn't take us very, very long to do.
Great.
Tori, why don't you lead us off?
I got over 10,000.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. What's your cumulative now?
It's 10,009. I literally just fudged something to make it happen. I was like, I am not quitting now.
Nice. So that gives you 506 words today.
Yep. Not too bad.
Oh, cool. Alrighty. Kitty, how about you?
I got no words. I am fighting a cold.
Mm.
And have spent most of the day asleep or at my day job.
No fun. How about you, Gail? What was your day like today?
I don't think I got any words, because I'm done. So
right.
I'm doing rewriting and rereading now, and I didn't get too much of that today. But I'm at 79236, which I don't think is really anything, because there's a lot of deleting things and putting things back in and stuff like that.
6-word gain.
Oh, my God. I still haven't. I still have not gotten to eat sushi, because we put sushi off, because I haven't, like, strictly, I don't consider a book finished until everything is marked first draft. So I have little triggers on all of my scenes in Scrivener, and
yep.
there's a to-do, there's a working, and then there's a first draft trigger, and those are the stages. And so until the whole document has a first draft tick next to it, essentially, I don't get my sushi. So I don't get my sushi yet.
But, so do you think you'll be able to get your sushi before our final day?
If I sit down and do this tomorrow, I should get sushi tomorrow night. That's the
plan
anyway. It's just the last chapter I have to reread, and then
okay.
The whole thing needs a second draft pass, but I'm calling it for the first draft pass for this. That was my goal. So
nice.
So I really just need to reread the last chapter, and I just didn't get to it enough today. So tomorrow,
cool.
I hope. How about you?
That's a good thing. Well, I wound up with 52,326, which gave me 3,494 words for the day.
That's good.
And I've got some more in me tonight, I think, so I'll be getting a running start on tomorrow. I am now thick in what feels like the mid to late third act of 5.
Nice.
And just as an aside, that is officially your second best day of this month.
Oh, it is.
Oh,
let's see.
Nice.
What was my best day? 3,618. You're right, it was. Cool.
Pretty good, good. And,
but, thick, so everything's happening now. I've got, someone has, their big secret has been found off, and they have run away in shame because they think their big secret makes them a suspect in the murder, and so do several of the people they're running from. So now they are having to search the ship. Meanwhile, there's another party in the, going EVA, and everything's in chaos, and, the tension is ramping up.
Fantastic.
So I'm having fun.
Cool. Very cool. So question from the forum then.
Yeah, let's see. Question from the forum. What do we got? This one, it will be from JR. Who says, I write military science fiction, and the readers come to me with a base set of understandings about the culture of service and an entry level of tactical acumen. Swabby and Zoomy readers. I don't know what that means. Even my Swabby and Zoomy readers get the gist of the basics. I can get away with fudging some explanations on complex topics because the reader base is already with me. I can tell them Private Joe Snuffy pied a corner for a sneak peek without any issues because they know what that tactical maneuver is. However, sometimes books surprise you with how they tackle the cultural zeitgeist and then cross over into the wider world of science fiction. So, how hard do you try to make your story accessible to the uninitiated while servicing your existing audience?
This is a very good question. And my answer is, I do this similarly with fashion. So I'm very well versed in fashions of the Victorian era and food of the Victorian era and the terms by which they are called, which are mostly French. And I will use those without explaining it to the reader because I am assuming that all of my characters understand. If I say fichu, they all know what a fichu is. And so I will just stick that word into the book and move on. But I always make sure that in context, everybody understands that a fichu is something like a shawl that's covering the top of a gown or something, right?
So like everybody, she wrapped her fichu around her shoulders.
Around her neck or around her shoulders, right? So everybody knows what the purpose of the fichu is. So if then somebody is knitting one or it gets torn off, or because I'm not going to mention it if it's not going to become part of the story, that they all get what kind of article of clothing it is. So you should do the same thing with your military terms. Yeah. It's absolutely fine, especially if it's a searchable term that you can just search and Wikipedia will give you a basic explanation, to just say they did the cat of nine tails maneuver, right? <You know? laughs>
I think that's a kink term, not a military term.
You know.
It could be used in the military in some eras.
We don't, occasionally,
are you going to start writing military erotica?
All I'm saying is you can get away with that so long as everybody then knows that it is a guerrilla warfare tactic or it is a naval tactic that involves a bay and, three submarines or whatever it is that, like, so long as your use of the term does not further confuse your readers into annoyance, it's fine to put a term that they don't know in. Especially in science fiction and fantasy, where generally speaking, readers are way more adaptable and comfortable with strange terms being thrown at them because they're
They get annoyed if they don't have at least one or two of those per book sometimes.
Yeah, because figuring out what the word means in the context of your universe is part of the discovery of the reading experience to particularly sci-fi and fantasy genre readers. They really like, the Tesseract. They want to learn about the Tesseract and understand what the Tesseract is during the course of the book.
And also research is a big part of it. It always makes me feel good if I don't know something and I can go and research what that means. It makes me feel happy in some way.
And you'll get readers who will email you who will be like, oh my god, because you used that word I went and looked it up and I have a new favorite thing or what have you. It's really fun.
And the same principle extends to crime fiction as well. I found that in my mysteries, the more terse I am, the better they play. It's the terms of art, as long as they're not obscuring what's going on, you can basically leave them for the readers to work out. And in fact, readers who get into the story want to have the hard terminology because it makes them feel like they're part of the in-group.
They like the mystery of it. They're mystery readers, right?
Well, that too, right? And of course, there's always going to be, JR, like you have, with your core group of readers who all understand the basics of military service. If you get it wrong, you will hear about it. So in mystery fiction, if I get a point of police procedure wrong, or a point of firearms wrong, or a point of the law wrong, well, the law, I really care about. The readers don't care about that so much, because crime fiction readers, except for procedural readers, tend not to know the law except through what they've been exposed to through the books. But the immersion and the transparency of all of that, the terminology, the mindset and whatnot, are part of why people read genre fiction. If they wanted the world explained to them as to a four-year-old, they would go to litfic. or if they wanted to be obscured for no particular reason, they'd go to litfic.
They like watching an author be clever if they feel like they have a hand in that cleverness, or they can, mm-hmm. they will come out the other side feeling cleverer themselves.
Yeah, they like to feel like they're in the hand of an expert guide through this strange corner of the world.
Yeah, whether that's an alien landscape that you've invented completely out of your head, or, you know, an all-historical world with vampires and werewolves in it. When, you know, like, when I drop a thing about, like, I don't know, Henry VIII splitting with the Church of England over vampires, or the Catholic Church over vampires, like, all, and you know, and casually just saying, and the divorce was a front, like, everybody uh-huh. who knows, and, you know, that moment of history thinks it's hilarious and clever and how fun this is, right? And everyone else is like, what's going on?
And it explains why Anne Boleyn lost yeah, her head.
Exactly. But you can be fun with it in that kind of way, where yeah. it's not necessarily, I'm going to be purposefully obfuscate things and make readers feel stupid. It's more, come with me, my darling reader. Like, the two mm-hmm. of us are going to, like, learn something exciting together, either about reality or this world that I have built. And mm-hmm. then we'll be in on a kind of a joke together. Like, we'll be in on this bit of knowledge.
Yep.
And it's super fun when you are somebody like me who drops tiny nuggets of, like, archaeological knowledge or a term that is so obscure. And, like, nobody... Is it like so I have a nerd character in my last San Andreas book use the swear word coprolite. and I have a friend who's one of my former colleagues from when I was doing my PhD, who I didn't even know read these books and, like, outed herself as reading my super sexy
nice.
Stuff. But she emailed me, or she just posted a comment. She basically was like, you use coprolite as a swear word. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, I was like, I've literally waited 20 years to use coprolite as a swear word. And I had a bunch of fans of that particular series just be like, I had to look up what that meant. And now I am delighted. And I was like, yes. Because when I was teaching freshman year, I was like, the only thing I want you guys leaving Intro to Archaeology with is an understanding of what a coprolite is and why they're so important.
Same. Well, I'm doing some stuff with archaeology because I kind of shifted as well. And I'm learning to include those words that are not layman term, right?
Yeah.
And expecting that people will look them up. Because yeah. otherwise I feel like I'm, I don't know... Like, it's too...
Pedantic?
Explainy.
Yeah, it's too pedantic, yeah. yeah. So I feel like I'm playing to something that I don't really like. So I'm kind of using a lot of these words that we would use as archaeologists, because it is partially on a dig site. And how do y'all feel about footnotes? To describe those.
You can have...
If you have too many.
It can work depending on the style of the narrative.
It can work. Yes. It depends on how strong your author voice is. So we're back to the Terry Pratchett thing of yesterday. Mm-hmm. I would be more inclined to have two experts argue over something, and in the course of their arguing over it, therefore explain what's going on to the reader. But also you can use characterization. So if you have, like, a super pedantic, like, theory-driven... archaeology supervisor, right, who's, like, maybe anti-repatriation or, like is kind of got a colonialistic mentality or agenda, like a negative character, you can have them, like, argue over something. You know, like, you can showcase two different kinds of academia I did that in... I have two characters in one of my series that, like, get into... Like, there's a, like, knockdown, screaming fight between these two characters who are friends and friendly characters, but have kind of hated each other. They're friends with everybody else. And it turns out that they're arguing over whose name is first on a byline, which is, like, such an academic thing to
such
do.
Such an inside baseball really thing, yeah.
But it also allowed me to, like, advance two different, like, because they're also arguing about, like, sort of theories of why shapeshifters exist. But, you know, it allowed me to advance all of this world understanding to my readers that the two scientist characters had come across. Well, they're literally, like, trying to throttle each other in the middle of a shifter, like, fight sequence, and arguing over a byline. So you can actually use transfer of information nuggets like this, and explanation of words for which your reader base probably does not have the expertise, as characterization as well, which is really fun.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask, because I have two, I was going to either do footnotes or have two people who are sort of like a TA or something who's teaching somebody, and so they kind of hear these, you can explain it in that way that makes it feel more realistic.
That would be my inclination, especially if you're on a site that's a teaching site, you know, and you have undergrads there. They're there to learn anyway, so they don't know how to use a plumbob. Then you can explain how to use a plumbob for your SCARP, and therefore explain what plumbob and SCARP are, right?
And to dovetail with our, this dovetails with our conversation last night about point of view. The with a really voicey narrator like Terry Pratchett or Douglas Adams, you can get away with footnotes, and with a narrative conceit that involves editorialization, you can get away with footnotes. So, like, my current book, I haven't needed to use one, but I can resort to footnotes if I need to, because the conceit of the book, starting with line one, is that this is a revisionist history of events that happened in the early 22nd, or in the early 21st century. And so, in that kind of thing, you would expect footnotes. I haven't had to use any yet, but I've got the option open.
One of the excavations I was on just sort of press ganged one of the student excavators into doing a blog about her experience on the excavation. And that is could be a similar kind of, and this was in the early days when blogs were like a new thing. And, you know, this is in the 90s. And that could be that would be kind of a conceit that you could use. And you could also introduce a Lower Decks perspective under those circumstances. If most of your characters are, you know, the higher level, the teachers or the professors or whoever's investigating the murder, you could have, if you wanted to, you could introduce commentary, you know, from a student who's like, what the hell is going on? You know, but you don't necessarily have to do that. I think you can do it through, I think you can do it through characterization. That tends to be my inclination. Although I have a very strong author voice and I do use it for, you know, Pratchett or more Pratchett, I would say, more sort of Pratchett like interjections, but I tend to do it with parentheses, and that is because I love parentheses and I hate that the fiction world says you're not allowed to use parentheses, so I put parentheses in almost every book I write. I love them, and they are my, and that is narrator voice interjection almost always, unless I'm doing such a deep POV that parentheses are actually the character's interjection, but it's usually me. It is really Gail just being like, I have something to say that the character wouldn't say, but I'm going to say it in parentheses.
Nice.
So that is another option, is bring back the parentheses!
Now, to finish up, JR, your example of Private Joe Snuffy pied a corner for a sneak peek without any issues. You could get away with doing that if the fact that he's doing that isn't important to the action. If it is important to the action, then at some point in the story, before he does it, when it is important to the action, there should be enough context that someone who doesn't know the terms can figure out what that means.
Yes.
And that's how you get around that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I am with Dan 110%, because that sentence made no sense to me at all. I would even say if you're ever going to use a term that there's a good chance 90% of your audience doesn't understand, or that you should provide context. Like, it's kind of your duty to, like, so for example, plumbob, I tend to consider a thing that many, many, many craft persons should know a plumbob, but you'd be shocked how few people know it, or if they do not know that that's its correct terminology for it. So if I were going to mention that in the context of an excavation site or something, I would at least describe how it's that it's being dangled in order to make a straight edge.
He held the string and dropped the weight on the plumbob. Yeah,
exactly.
That kind of thing.
I would at least just give some kind of context so everybody knew it was a measuring tool of some kind. That should be sufficient, unless, of course, losing the plumbob or the weight of it or the shape of it turn it into like a weapon or something later on, and then you should try to describe those aspects of it. So right. I think knowing what the obscure term is going to become and why you're putting it in as an author is indicative as to what kind of context you're going to give to surround that term. So there it is. But then, I mean, there are also all of that said, like Dan said with mystery readers, there are also layman readers of genres that are more forgiving. So I really love military science fiction and space operas in particular, but I know nothing about the military, and I know nothing about most of the tactics that they are talking about in, you know, something like Elizabeth Moon's Vadas War or something. But I will happily consume that, and I have no idea what's going on in the battle sequence, but I know that, like, this is exciting, and people are dying, and there's some sort of catastrophe, and, like, big ships are, you know, and I'm like, I don't really care that much, right? Like, I'm just, and I think that you will find that there are readers, that there are what I would call layman readers of something like military sci-fi, who are just there because there are other tropes about that particular genre that they're attracted to, and they're just going to be very, very forgiving about terminology.
That's a very good point. So, we've done a very good job at beating the question to death without answering it in a firm fashion, which I think means our work is done.
Well, JR keeps asking us these kinds of questions which there is open-ended no firm question, answer, so... Yeah. Thank you, JR, for some great questions, I have to say.
Indeed, indeed. And we are now out of questions on the forums, so if you want to have us answer questions while the panel is still operative, get them in while you can.
Is your chance.
Can get to it. jdsawyer.net/forums, or find a link in the show notes and on the webpage at everydaynovelist.com. And that wraps us up for today. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. I'll see you all tomorrow.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.